My dad was primarily a bad cop. Not a bad person, but bad cop. It was especially hard for him raising me alone because he had these ideals of what his only son should do, which should be. And having gone through so much on his own, I think that there was this expectation that I would be better than he was now given the opportunity of this American dream that he had provided. It was hard when he learned that I have a mental disability.
Welcome to Rock the Boat. We're your hosts, Lucia Liu and Lin Gui. Together, we have candid conversations with Asian Americans who are challenging the status quo. We uncover stories about their upbringing, their relationship with family, Asian identity, and their work. In the past, we've interviewed Andrew Yang, Michelle Phan, and the Fung Bros. This season, we're featuring Asian Americans who have overcome challenges against all odds. Join us for our boldest season yet. The voice you heard in the clip at the beginning of the episode, that was John Chang. John is a 2019 Forbes 30 Under 30 list maker, an expert digital growth and product marketer, and a recognized global educator and keynote speaker. John's currently the head of growth at Klarna. He's also New York University's adjunct faculty of social media and web analytics. John previously worked at IBM Watson, Kickstarter, Stack Overflow, General Assembly, and MakerBot. John's veneer of success belies his struggle with a mental illness that only affects 1% of the world's population, bipolar disorder. Just a word of warning, there are topics of self-harm and suicide in this episode. If you're not comfortable with these topics, we recommend that you skip this episode.
My name is John Chang, and I live in New York City, do a whole bunch of stuff here. I do have a full-time job marketing, and then on the side, I love speaking and teaching. Bipolar disorder is a chemical imbalance in the brain that manifests as a mood disorder, and the moods are very extreme in both directions, meaning that as someone who lives with bipolar disorder comes with the risks of going on either side of those spectrums when I slip into mania. So mania itself is the elation period and delusion and all that kind of stuff, but within a manic episode, there's the mania and then there's the manic depressive part of it.
John wasn't always this open about his mental health, partly because bipolar disorder is often talked about with contempt or confusion, but also because his symptoms didn't manifest until he was a preteen.
I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, which is kind of like the suburbs anywhere. And I grew up as the youngest of four. And my sisters are like 13 years, 11 years older than me. My dad was very stereotypically, well, the son in the family needs to be strong and I'm gonna reflect in the ways that made me strong. And then my mom actually passed away when I was 8.
Before his mom passed away, John had been known as kind of a goofball. He was involved in a lot of activities, soccer, basketball, piano, violin, you name it.
I have many memories when my mom would scold me in public, and of course, a lot of Chinese moms scold in public, period. But at practice, I would be the one kind of goofing off on the side and like dancing. And I had this special like butt rump dance that she really did not like. It was a little too eccentric for that. I was that kid. When my mom was around. And then afterwards, so she passed when I was 8, I ended up actually going to the principal's office a bunch because I ended up acting out in more violent ways towards the other kids. And it was just very triggered very easily. And at that time, I get it. It's with kids going through that kind of trauma, there's acting out. And as I know now with like my mental health, my mental illness and everything, there were like multiple things happening at that time.
As John became a teenager, he started to feel different, but he didn't know how to define it.
It's shocking how I didn't realize it or recognize it because of all of the textbook characteristics that were happening, but I just didn't really have a benchmark and didn't have other people to talk about this kind of stuff with. So one of the things that ended up happening, my senior year of high school, that second semester, I was seeing this girl and she decided to stop seeing me because of all of my erratic behavior. Like I was so needy, like I had separation anxiety and all that kind of stuff. And that pretty much like broke me because of how sensitive and how I had not yet put into place coping mechanisms. So I ended up trying to kill myself and was also in a long history at that point of self-injury. So I would find ways since fifth grade to go and injure myself. All of that came out of the woodwork when I was at this one friend's party and her dad saw me in their bathroom injuring myself and eventually went to the hospital. I felt ashamed a little bit because when someone else has a reaction to it and someone else finally knows and sees, things become a lot more clear because then there's a different benchmark. There's actually a benchmark. And I was like, this person who I think is completely sane or whatever and normal in my mind back then is having this reaction to what I'm doing. Therefore, I'm starting to realize just how insecure and dangerous what I'm doing actually is. The other part is that lingering feeling, that lingering thought of what my family and my dad will think.
Did your dad know that you were hurting yourself?
There's one time in fifth grade when I was drawing diagrams on my hand in the form of cutting myself, and I was sent home, but my dad just told me to stop doing it. And what I did instead is I started doing it in places where people couldn't see.
Was he worried about it after he saw you hurting yourself?
I don't know if he wasn't worried about it, but if he was, he didn't show it.
He describes his dad as the disciplinarian of the family and attributes it to him being in the Taiwanese army. When his mom died, he became closer with his sisters, but still had a complicated relationship with his dad. His sisters were also unaware how to approach the situation, and to be fair, they were still growing up themselves when their mom died, and they took on the co-parenting role. John was the baby of the family, and they weren't equipped with the tools to handle this delicate, life-altering behavior, especially when mental health was rarely discussed in the family.
There was even one time when we were at brunch after I was already in the hospital and people knew that I started just crying at the table because I was trying to figure out what was happening with my body, and they just started antagonizing me about how strong I was and how, you know, like things that they went through and all that kind of stuff. I like to say I do love my sisters, we get along, but it was really the first time my family in general talked about mental health, and they were going through their own things as well, but this was that period of time when we had to address it.
So what's it like having a manic episode?
So a manic episode, and these are usually specific to bipolar disorder, it's an episode where someone has a period of elation and characteristics are often delusion, but usually this is a person who in this state of mind thinks they can do anything, they're over eccentric, they have a lot of energy and can get by without very little sleep. So it's a chemical imbalance that happens in someone's brain. And one of the ways that I like describing it is if a normal person's emotional range is from a 3 to a 7, a manic episode is at 8, 9, and 10. A manic episode feels real good during the mania. It feels great, like, and I think that's why there's a lot of the delusion as well, because it feels good being really confident and thinking I can do anything. There's one point where I jumped out of my second story bedroom window as a teenager because I thought I could fly. And that, I think that's the most delusional I've ever been, but that was years of being untreated.
Also, what about your dad and your sisters? Did they find out?
Well, they didn't know that I jumped out of the window. So I ended up in a bush. And then I like went around the house and I got the big ladder. I put it against the window, I climbed back and I just went to bed. I ended up getting in really big trouble because my dad thought I was sneaking out to go drink and hang out with friends. He was like, why is there a ladder there? And that was the conclusion. So the perception is actually very different than what happened.
Despite his erratic behavior, John wasn't diagnosed with bipolar disorder until college.
During college and right after college, I did my own little study. I went to multiple psychiatrists and I had them assess me, and I didn't tell them that I thought I was bipolar. I just wanted to do them to give me a diagnosis. They all came back with bipolar disorder. And then eventually ended up doing a thyroid test and a CAT scan as well, because those are other ways that you can confirm it. But it was just like what I was doing was so textbook that it was easy to diagnose. But then there's other people where it manifests here and there and it's really hard to tell. They end up getting diagnosed with something else. Like some people get diagnosed with ADHD. However, the medication for that is a trigger for a manic episode. And so it's highly problematic when there's erratic behavior like that, but it's misdiagnosed or misperceived.
John sometimes wonders if his bipolar disorder was something he inherited from his parents.
One of the issues with both of them being immigrants to the United States and their family's history is that we don't have medical records of their family's history. And in addition to that, especially in Taipei, let alone here in the 60s, they were not going to go see a therapist or get diagnosed or even acknowledge that they weren't strong enough to deal with their emotions. And that's a lot of what like my dad and my mom carried into the family. My mom and my dad would kind of like build and trigger each other, but my mom would like pull my sister out of the shower and just start yelling at her.
He thinks it's possible his bipolar disorder was genetic, but since his parents never received mental health treatment, the origin is still unknown.
So for many Asian families, it's not very acceptable to talk about mental health issues. It's sort of a private matter that can even be considered impolite. These prejudices can run deep to the point that it's considered better to deal with pain privately, even if it's detrimental to your and your future children's long-term wellness. Asian Americans are 3 times less likely to seek mental health services than Caucasians, according to the American Psychological Association. Despite reporting fewer mental health conditions, they are more likely to attempt suicide. There are several barriers that Asian Americans face when seeking help from mental health professionals, including language barriers, stigma, and just lack of awareness of resources.
A year and a half ago, John decided to go public with his bipolar disorder to help raise awareness. Here's John speaking about it on stage.
My dad was primarily a bad cop. Not a bad person, but bad cop. It was especially hard for him raising me alone because he had these ideals of what his only son should do, which should be. And having gone through so much on his own, I think that there was this expectation that I would be better than he was now given the opportunity of this American dream that he had provided. It was hard when he learned that I have a mental disability. It was hard for him to learn that his son was not strong in that way, per se, and there's a huge taboo and a stigma around it. Just imagine what was going through his head, that all of these ideals, all of these expectations for his only son, and just shattered. And he only said one thing to me that entire night, and he just told me that my mom would have been ashamed. So we went home, and he went to his room. I rummaged around for just around the house, and I found a big bottle of Advil, and I ate it all. And that was the night I tried to kill myself because my good cop wasn't there and I had imagined that my good cop could never be ashamed of me. So it was ever since I started speaking publicly about this, I started sharing on Facebook. You know, on Facebook you can decide whether it's public or friends or just some friends. I was like, oh God, I should just do this public. So I did it publicly and I like a few weeks later, I got word from my cousin that my dad knows.
How does your dad feel about you going public with your bipolar disorder?
You know what? Overall, in the way that we've talked about it, he has stated that he's proud that I'm taking risks with my career and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it may have been harder for him to like come to terms that I'm a marketer, but now with this.
You're obviously very accomplished career-wise. How do you balance your bipolar disorder with your teaching, mentoring, and your day job?
There have been times in the past where I know that I need to take care of myself, but I prioritize my work first, and I just know that I'm going to be in an episode, and I go do that. And it's really, really scary to think about, and I know it's high risk, but there are times in the past where I've prioritized my career and have intentionally gone into an episode. When I'm just working so much, I don't even notice it. I slipped into a pretty bad one in January, February because of the work situation. It was just working so much that I was kind of snapped out of it. But the work situation just was in an episode. I was like, I did not even see it coming or feel it coming on.
Yeah, it's very important to check yourself when you're working really hard, especially living in the city or working in tech or working at a startup. You have this very unhealthy relationship with work. It's just constant, never ending, especially Lynn, you mentioned amongst like the Asian American community, there's this like very strong work ethic.
Yeah. Here in America, we already have a very strong attachment to work. We derive a lot of our identity around work. Asians, growing up, were taught to work hard as well. So if you combine the two, you just create this insane culture around valuing ourselves around what we can produce.
Yeah, and in China nowadays, there's this concept of 996, which is you work 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week.
Yeah.
And it's this like glorified way of putting yourself to work.
Is it even glorified or is that the norm?
Oh, God, it's difficult to say. Like Jack Ma is a big supporter of 996. I think to some extent it is the norm. Mm-hmm. For John, he mentions that avoiding happy hours and other office get-togethers can sometimes help him prevent his episodes. But when he doesn't take care of himself at work, this usually leads to a bad outcome.
It's really hard because I can't organize my projects around my mental illness. Now there's times I just don't get things done because I need to take care of myself. But this is something I talk to employers about, and I force people to talk about it in the work situation, in the workplace.
How did they react when you quote unquote forced people to talk about it?
Even with friends, people will not look at me the same. Because then they'll start justifying. Like people usually say like, oh, you're being so bipolar right now. It's like, what? What words are coming out of your mouth right now? But people start putting me into their perception with the stigmas. I actually get a lot of people who tell me, well, I know someone who's bipolar, or I know someone who's really depressed, and they just start conflating different kinds of mental illnesses, which is fine because we're having the conversation, so.
I think there's a big stigma against mental illness within the Asian American community. I mean, one example of that is just the fact that we are often hesitant to go see a therapist or share that we are going to see a therapist. There's a sense that we can figure things out ourselves and that it's sort of a waste of money to talk to someone else about our problems.
Even in like Chinese specifically, when you say someone has a mental illness, you call them crazy or like shenjingbing, which means your nerve system is damaged. Mm-hmm. Like you have a damaged nerve system. It's definitely attached to some sort of anomaly, and there's definitely a stigma against associating with people who are mentally unwell.
It reminds me of like a caste system. It's like if you have a mental illness, it's all immediately downgraded to a lower caste because of it.
I told my mom recently when I was in Shanghai that I went and found a therapist this past January, and I've been working with her all throughout the year. And I think her initial reaction was a little confused because she's like, well, is there something wrong? Do you want to talk about it? And then later on, I kind of explained to her, I was like, no, it's like finding a personal trainer where they're able to help you think through problems and help you become more emotionally resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Personal trainer for your mind.
Exactly.
And emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. At least that's how I thought about it. And that's my approach to finding a therapist.
Yeah. I mean, I fundamentally believe that the way you manage your emotions and mind affects the rest of your life, perhaps even more so than your like physical health in some ways.
Yeah.
So it is totally worth the investment to go to a therapist. And I finally sort of bit the bullet a couple months ago as well and started going to see a therapist. Even though I'm not even on insurance and pay out of pocket, it's totally worth it for me.
How do you maintain your coping mechanisms in the day-to-day when things get really crazy?
Oftentimes, my mental illness is more detrimental to my day-to-day than my physical illness is. So I actually ended up taking, for the first time ever, personal days at work. I had a very, very real conversation with my manager and eventually ended up with my manager's manager about this and requesting time off for me to just lay in bed or do whatever I needed, like work out and stuff like that. But there is this like whole professional misconception. We refuse to put it in as like, oh, a mental health day is the same as taking a sick day and can actually have a bigger impact on your work-life balance. I took a personal day instead of a sick day for this kind of stuff. And it was because I was like, oh, well, it's not a sick day. This is a personal issue instead. And that's how I, in my head, and I kind of think it's kind of messed up how I did that to myself.
You know, John makes a really good point here. And we almost want to make it into a PSA on this podcast to say that, hey, if you're not in the right you know, headspace or you're feeling burnt out at work, it is absolutely okay to take a sick day as a mental health day. I have personally done it once or twice, especially when I felt very burnt out and I wasn't in peak performance and bringing my best self to work. I've taken a sick day and just took the day off to kind of regroup myself.
Absolutely, me too. Part of it is because my previous boss told me one time that I don't have to actually be physically sick in order to take a day off. It's
and
okay to just
really
take a mental health
boss.
Day.
Yeah, to be able to tell you that and be able to allow for you to have the time to yourself. Because I think we all have moments where we're overwhelmed or we feel a lot of anxiety about an upcoming project. And to be able to feel like, hey, you know what? I just need to take a pause right here and breathe.
And not only are you doing yourself a favor, you're probably doing your team and the rest of the company a favor too by just, you know, recentering yourself and getting yourself to a better place mentally.
Right, right. And we actually ask John this, you know, what can bosses and coworkers do to make the workplace more mental health friendly?
Well, one of the things I've done as a manager before, and I've gotten good feedback about it from my direct reports, is having during check-ins, make part of it an EQ check-in. So we have our performance check-ins, what are the blockers with your work, how is this progressing, yada, 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 but then also how are you feeling day to day? And I have phrased it very openly, how are you feeling in your personal life, and is that something that you feel like you need time and so forth?
John's coping mechanisms have been developed on his sick days and check-ins with himself. The process is twofold. There's reactionary. So if an event unfolds that he doesn't have control over, and there's preventative. It's how he prepares daily before an event may unfold. And both are very powerful.
For the reactionary, I mean, I do isolate myself. I'm like, I'm not gonna hang out tonight. Like, I need to stay home. I'm gonna go like watch a movie and like cuddle with my dog or something, because cuddling with a dog is not the coping mechanism. It's removing myself from the social situations.
It's a consistent process of checking in with yourself, even when things seem fine.
It's definitely been a lot of trial and error, because one of the things that's really hard to measure for myself is the intensity of what I feel. And there's a fine line in the tipping point. It's like when I feel like there's symptoms and there's signs, but I don't always know like how intense it is, and then I don't necessarily catch it. So there's self-awareness to know the situations, but after that, there's a lot of trial and error.
So something that I've encountered is this app called Wobot. It's an AI-powered therapy chatbot that will check in with you every single day on how your mood is. And it actually teaches you cognitive behavioral therapy, which is all about the theory that your thoughts control your emotions, which then control your actions. And it becomes this vicious cycle where if your thoughts are negative, then your emotions are going to be negative, and then your actions are going to be negative, which then kind of fuels the cycle. And in order to break the cycle, you start changing your thoughts. So a lot of the things that the chatbot teaches you is about black and white thinking. So if you say things like, you know, I'm never going to be good enough, or I always do this wrong, I always screw this up. It's changing that thought process into something that's a bit more factual, which is, you know, you don't always screw things up. It's sometimes you screw it up. And that's okay. We're all human.
Ever find it weird that you're essentially just talking to a robot?
No, because I kind of know that it's a robot. I don't really, you kind of understand that it's almost like a survey. And based on your survey responses, it kind of spits out a formula for you. The things that it would say is like, okay, you know, if you're feeling anxious, then it will say, okay, do you want to talk about it, or do you want to solve the problem? And you can choose whichever. If it's like you want to talk about it, you'll list the things that you say, and then it will identify certain issues with your statement. Like, does it have black and white thinking? Does it have future telling or like mind reading, which is thinking that you know what other people think, which is not true. Mm-hmm. So it'll help you identify your cognitive distortions, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Or if you choose the calm me down path, then it walks you through mindfulness exercises. Sometimes they'll walk you through exercises where you take a cold patch and you put it on your neck and just breathe so that it
So it'll just explain how to do these exercises over chat.
Right, okay. Exactly. It's not like it will, you know, analyze everything that you say. It's more so that it gives you a formula and a framework to understand what is happening to you, why you're feeling certain emotional feelings, and how to deal and cope with those emotional feelings.
How would you compare that to your experience with a live, real in-person therapist?
I actually think it's more useful in some ways because I was on like a weekly cadence with my therapist, and she would always check in with me and be like, okay, well, so how are you feeling this week? Are there topics that you want to talk about? How's this thing going? And, you know, she'll kind of check in. But I don't feel like a lot of the exercises that she gives me are very immediate. And then also I'm not necessarily feeling all the emotions that I'm feeling, you know, let's say after an argument or after I feel really overwhelmed doing a task. It's not like she's right there versus this chatbot is right there. So like if you approach it and you have an issue, it can at least kind of walk you through. I mean, there are times when it doesn't make sense and you're just like, okay, I don't want to deal with this. And you actually just want to talk to a real person. That's totally fine. Yeah. In moments where you're kind of just introspecting and you're like, what's wrong? I don't really understand. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat helpful because it just teaches you all of the different tactics and ways to cope.
Well, check it out, guys. We will include a link to Wobot, which is an app you can download, right?
Yeah, we'll include the link in our show notes.
While regulating one's mood and keeping track of your triggers is a great way to self-regulate, in clinically diagnosed mental health patients, medication is still important despite its side effects.
We used to call it the zombie medication because I would just kind of not remember periods of time and just have no emotion. The psychology of it for me felt really scary because, and I think this is common, I hear it a lot from people who I commiserate with, who also have bipolar disorder, is that we knowingly know that we're giving up essentially different parts of our personality. So I feel like I still like am like quirky and stuff, but I was known as being the very eccentric person. It was like even like part of my leadership style and all that kind of stuff. And I knew that I was giving that up because that was an unhealthy way to live. People often go off their medication for the same reason and also don't start medication. And that's what kind of prevented me from going on my medication. And I even went off of it for a little bit in college for that exact reason. So even the thought of doing it is already scary. And then afterwards, there's a totally noticeable change in personality. For me, it was like, oh, I'm gonna go be a boring person now.
So aside from suggesting Wobot, what is the most helpful thing that friends, real life in-person friends, can do for those who are experiencing mental health issues?
We ask John this, and this is what he said.
It is so situational. It depends on the illness as well, but I have like a few friends on speed dial, and they know that when I call them and I tell them like why I'm calling them, they just tell me a story. They tell me about their day, and they keep telling me about their day until like I calm down, I feel grounded. There's other times when I'll tell them my thought process and they help me understand what parts of my thought process are logical and illogical at that time. So they're like, tell me what's going on. And I'm like, well, this thing at work or whatever. And they're like, well, I think that you would deal with it this way if you weren't in an episode right now. Do you agree? And I'm like, I totally agree. So, okay, that it helps me kind of like separate out and better understand where I am at that time.
And as always, we ask our guests what rocking the boat means to them. For John, it's personal.
The boat to me is our culture and society, and rocking it is making it expand in being able to be less rigid. So some boats need to be rocked a little bit more, in my opinion. This is one, the perception of mental illness is one that I think is very, very rigid and needs large masses of people to go rock it together to get out of that.
Since going public about his bipolar disorder, John's sisters have started speaking more openly about his mental health disorder as well.
When I was talking to one of my sisters recently, like it's so much more comfortable talking about it because for work I've had to go to Chicago a bunch and I have a cute little dog aunt who I don't bring with because she just barely doesn't fit like under a seat or whatever the airplane requirements are. So my sister was saying, well, you can use bipolar disorder as a way to get the emotional support and stuff like that. And it was just nice for her to bring it up and in a way that wasn't like, oh, hide it.
So Lynn, you mentioned mental health really affects you personally as well as professionally, even sometimes more so than, you know, diet and exercise. We definitely want to make this episode a personal PSA to really take care of your mental health. It's so easy to get mired in the day-to-day. It's so easy to think that you have to perform and you have to compare yourself to other people. Especially living in the city, you feel like it's a constant rat race. But we want to make sure that you also have time to breathe.
Absolutely. And living with mental health issues doesn't have to mean your life is over. The biggest takeaway here for me is just to give yourself some time and some space and treatment. If it's helpful for you to talk to someone, make that investment in yourself. The biggest help I get from talking to a therapist is that she helps me reframe my thinking.
And I think at the end of the day, even if you're suffering from mental health issues, it doesn't mean that you can't be a successful person. Just look at John.
Thanks to our writer, Liz Roberts, for writing this episode. Liz works full-time at CNN Digital as an associate producer of content development. She's been told that food is not a passion, but she disagrees. And we do too.
Amen to that. Thanks for tuning in to Rock the Boat. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes and help spread the word about the podcast. We really appreciate your help. Kelsa Lim is our assistant producer, Debbie Wong and Kim Hernandez are our social media coordinators, and Rachel Chu is our sound editor. Be sure to follow us on social media at Rock the Boat NYC.